Welcome to the Standing Up to POTS podcast, otherwise known as the POTScast. This podcast is dedicated to educating and empowering the community about postural orthostatic tachycardia syndrome, commonly referred to as POTS. This invisible illness impacts millions, and we are committed to explaining the basics, raising awareness, exploring the research, and empowering patients to not only survive, but thrive. This is the Standing Up to POTS podcast.
Hello, fellow POTS patients and beautiful people who care about POTS patients. I'm Jill Brooke, your horizontal host, and today we are interviewing Dr. Asad Khan, retired physician and respiratory consultant from Manchester, England, and expert on long COVID and associated disorders like POTS, dysautonomia, ME/CFS, MCAS, and the lot. Dr. Khan is a prominent expert and advocate for those with these conditions, but this did come with a high cost to himself as he has long COVID, which is why he is now retired. But he is still a strong advocate and eloquent voice representing long COVID patients. Dr. Khan, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you ever so much, Jill. I'm so pleased to be here. It's a real privilege.
So maybe we can start by just sort of introducing people to your background. Do you mind talking about, maybe why don't we start pre-COVID? Do you want to talk about your training and background and what you were up to before COVID?
Sure. So I qualified for medical school in 1998. So I've been a doctor for quite a number of years. And just before I fell ill with the COVID infection that led to my long COVID in November 2020, I was working as a frontline respiratory consultant, seeing all the acutely ill COVID patients that were coming into hospital in the emergency department, but also on the respiratory wards. And the particular week that I caught the virus, I was assigned to this ward where there were 28 patients who had respiratory COVID. So they were patients who were breathless, who were coughing, and we were assigned for a week. So I was spent all day there. And I guess the term that your listeners might be more familiar with is the attending. So that's what I was. And that's what I've been since 2009 in various different hospitals in the UK, but also in New Zealand. So as was the case with a lot of hospitals, we didn't have adequate protection. So we had what was called PPE, but it wasn't really. It was a surgical mask and gloves and plastic apron. And we were meant to assess these patients wearing that. And we were told that this was sufficient because the virus was spread by droplets and that the proper PPE, the sort of FFP3s, the N95s, that was all reserved for what they called aerosol generating procedures, which, and you know, is a total nonsense because humans are aerosol generating creatures. We create aerosols when we cough, when we talk, when we laugh. Initially, in the first peak, it was a resource problem, but by the time I fell ill, it wasn't a resource issue. It was more a case of, well, the government had decided that the guideline would be that surgical masks were enough, and they didn't want to be seen to be going back on that, because that would make them lose their credibility, and it would demonstrate that they weren't standing by their guidance, and they got it wrong. So obviously governments don't like to admit that they've got things wrong, because that has consequences. And yeah, we were the fallouts from that. I lost in our organization, which is the largest NHS trust, which is the equivalent of a healthcare organization in the US. So it's the largest one in the UK. We lost four people, four died, and a number of us got long COVID. In fact, the number who got long COVID in our organization runs into the several hundreds.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And I was, to my knowledge, I was the worst affected of all of them. And I just got sicker and sicker. By September 2021, I was actually in really bad shape. And I know this podcast is about POTS, so with specific reference to POTS, it was so severe that all I had to do was lift my head off the pillow. And I'd be consumed by a wave of nausea. And my routine was this. I'd spend 5 to 15 minutes lying flat, but then I had gastroparesis, a paralyzed stomach, which often people with POTS have. So I would get nausea from the pressure of the stomach. So then I would have to lift my head up to relieve that sensation. And then obviously, because you reduce your cerebral blood flow by doing that, that would give me a different kind of nausea. Yeah, I mean, I laugh now, but it was torture. And I remember at that time, I also had extreme stimulus sensitivity where, you know, I couldn't look at a phone screen. I couldn't bear a sliver of light coming through the blinds. I couldn't tolerate anything more than a whisper. I actually could not tolerate my children being in the room. Just the knowledge that they were there consumed so much energy that I used to get neuropathic pain in my hands. And I just thought, this is so bizarre. Like, I've never come across anything like this. How can this be going on? It was only, you know, through my own reading that I subsequently realized that I had a broken battery, like a lot of people with these energy limiting illnesses have, and things that normally you wouldn't notice just consume your energy. Yeah. So it was a really difficult time, and I was in that position for several months. And I ended up being my own physician, because the normal route by which you get investigated and treated in the UK just wouldn't work for me. I tried it, but got the same sort of feedback that a lot of people listening would have had. Your tests are normal, you know, maybe you're anxious. We don't know anything about long COVID. We're not sure what to do. So then began the process of actually proactively seeking out private physicians who had shown an interest in these conditions, or who maybe had a background in POTS or ME/CFS already. And then referring myself to them, getting assessed by them, and then conveying their recommendations to my own doctor.
Wow.
In the hope that they would follow through. And I was lucky to have a really good primary care physician who, for the most part, you know, would follow those recommendations. But I know a lot of people haven't had that success. But I guess the point I'm trying to make is that despite being medically qualified, and actually not just medically qualified, but being in quite a senior position, it was the battle. And This is despite having knowledge of the system, having contacts. And I cannot imagine what it's like for people who don't have that privilege. Their learning curve must be so much steeper than mine. And I remember, as part of my assessment, when I finally did manage to get into an NHS hospital for autonomic testing, I was sent for tilt testing. And I remember going on the tilt table. I mean, getting there was a story in itself, but anyway. I lasted probably all of 2 or 3 minutes, and I just felt like I was going to throw up. So they abandoned the test because I couldn't tolerate it. And I remember a few weeks later getting a letter in which the reporting physician said, no evidence of autonomic dysfunction.
What?
Yes. Because I hadn't hit the criteria on the tilt test, but I hadn't lasted long enough. So, you know, whatever changes there were didn't hit the targets. So therefore, no evidence of autonomic dysfunction, when really it was just an incomplete investigation. And this has become a bit of a passion of mine, a bit of a hobby of mine, where we are so attached to these numbers. And the criteria for POTS, they're plucked out of the air, aren't they? You know, based on one study in the 90s. And, you know, if somebody hits the criteria of 28 beats per minute increase on one day. What's to say that on another day, they might not have 32? But so often patients are told, well, you don't fit the criteria for POTS, therefore we're discharging you, off you go. And there is so much more to this condition than the heart rate changes, isn't there?
And here in the United States, the insurance coverage for treatments oftentimes is riding on whether or not you meet some criteria or some number. And being one beat per minute short can keep you from having your drugs covered and tests covered and things like that. I don't know how it is in the UK.
So, I mean, we have very poor access to autonomic testing, full stop. You know, in the region where I live, in northwestern England, there isn't a single specialist in dysautonomia. Wow. No neurologist, and it's a very large region. It's got a population of 5 million. And so I actually had to go out of the region for my assessments. I had to go to London. And what you have is some cardiologists who have maybe a peripheral knowledge of POTS, which is linked to the criteria again. And the typical sort of trajectory of the patient is they wait months after being referred by their general practitioner to see these cardiologists or neurologists. In the meantime, they get no treatment, because there is this thinking that you have to have a tilt table and you have to hit these criteria to have treatment. And meanwhile, the patient's done all their research and they've learned about salt and fluid and compression and lying down and avoiding, you know, heavy meals. So they've done all of that in the meantime. Then they go to see the clever cardiologist who tells them exactly the same thing. and then they have a tilt table test. And then they, if they're unlucky enough not to hit the criteria, then it's off you go. So it's quite similar. Now, I'm probably being a bit harsh on my colleagues here, because I do think, you know, things have moved on a little bit in the last 5 years, because there obviously has been an explosion of people with autonomic problems. And there are some people in the United Kingdom who do specialize in this and were doing so before COVID hit, but they're just totally overwhelmed. But what we don't have still is physicians, whether they're specialists, whether they're primary care physicians, who will listen to the story and, based on the symptoms and some office testing, say, right, well, your symptoms are consistent with orthostatic intolerance. There are things we can do for this in terms of drugs. Even if you don't hit the criteria, let's try these treatments. And as you know, a lot of these treatments are actually quite cheap and quite safe. So I just think it's totally unacceptable that we have this strict approach that we have. And there are people who are doing office tests now. So the active strand test or the nasoline test. And I know that they are controversial as to how well validated they are. But my thinking is that, well, if it's positive, it's actually really useful and gives you enough information to treat. But also, even if it's not positive and the patient develops symptoms, that's telling you something, that there's something going on. The blood is not reaching the top half of the body. That's what's going on, isn't it? For whatever reason, that is treatable. It might not be curable, but there are things we can do for this. And it's actually really infuriating that a simple fact like that, we're not looking out for that actively, and we're not doing something about it. I just find it bizarre. I mean, I have POTS, and I, right at the beginning, when I developed dysautonomia, and this is before I was in this really severe state, I had an inappropriate sinus tachycardia. So I was going at, you know, 130, 140 beats a minute at rest, doing nothing. And I was like that for months. So obviously my heart rate wasn't going to increase by 30. It was already quite high. You know, I know in some people it does, but in my case, that just didn't happen. But I felt dreadful on standing. I just couldn't tolerate it. So, you know, I never hit the criteria. I have never had a positive pill test, active sound test, or naphthalene test. But does that mean that I don't have orthostatic intolerance? Of course not. And the one test I really wanted to have, which nobody would offer me, it just wasn't available, or I was told, no, we don't normally do that. We only do that in research settings, was the transcranial Doppler, where, you know, you scan the cranium lying down, and then you sit or stand the patient up and see if the blood flow reduces by a certain amount.
Yeah.
And that is almost universally present in patients who have orthostatic intolerance, regardless of whether they hit the what's criteria. Now, if you look at patients with ME/CFS, or if you look at the ME/CFS kind of long COVID patients, there's been multiple papers that have demonstrated the same. And it's a simple non-invasive test. And I just don't understand why we don't do it. So yeah, in a nutshell, I despair. And I despair because I was able to get some relief because I knew people and I managed to get my hands on medication relatively early. But I don't need to tell your listeners how long the average wait is before people get diagnosed with POTS. And it's such a miserable condition. It's so debilitating. It actually causes a significant reduction in the quality of life. I don't know how people carry on for years with those symptoms. But it's not just the heartbeat, is it? It's hard to describe when you're at the worst. That I remember lying flat and going, I wish I could actually make the bed flatter. And it was as flat as it could be. I had no pillows. And then I remember actually having to tilt my head downwards to be able to just sort of stay.
Wow. And,
it can be like torture. I mean, you know, I'm sure there are people who are much worse than that. And I'm sure there are people who maybe haven't experienced that severity of symptoms. But it is a serious condition, and it is disabling. It affects quality of life. And just because it's not fatal in most cases, doesn't mean that it's not important or it isn't life-changing.
Yes, and I'm sure that a lot of our listeners don't have a POTS diagnosis because of the reasons you said. Maybe their heart rate only went up 29 beats per minute. And so I'm sure that they're comforted a little bit to know that in your mind, that all of those details are somewhat, you know, not the most important thing when the rest of the picture is looking like POTS.
Yeah. I mean, what I would say is that these tests are useful if they're positive. But if they're negative, it doesn't mean that the patient doesn't have a problem. And then it really boils down to the story. And as we were taught in medicine, you know, it's in the history, in what the patient is telling you. If the patient is telling you that they have symptoms that only occur or get worse when they are either sitting or standing, you've more or less got your diagnosis. Not many conditions do that. So, and there are things you can do. So maybe the heart rate isn't going up, right? Okay, they've stood for 10 minutes, or they've had a tilt for 10 minutes. The heart rate's not going up, but they're feeling breathful. Well, you know, as long as the blood pressure tolerates it, you can still try drugs like nidrine to improve the circulation to the upper half of the body. You can still try pyridostigmine. You can still try, again, if the blood pressure tolerates it, the fever cortisone. So things that you can do, it's not just about rate control. And I just don't think patients get that. And I'm certain that that's the case here. And I'm pretty sure that is the case in the US as well.
And I think that's related to something I've heard you say before. I believe that you have said that COVID is not just a respiratory disease and that it's not benign to keep getting it. Can you talk about that and sort of the larger picture of long COVID besides just POTS?
Sure. So, I mean, it's an evolving area, but what we do know is that it is very well researched. We don't have all the answers. We certainly don't have any sort of approved treatments. Most treatments that we have are symptomatic or experimental, but we've got a reasonably good understanding of what is going on in the body in terms of the pathophysiology. And not everything will be happening in every patient. But one thing that is happening in every patient where it has been looked for is the coagulation abnormalities. So clots, thick blood. So I have collaborated with a group, which is now international, but started off in a lab in South Africa, where Professor Rhys Pretorius found small clots in the plasma of long COVID patients. And this shouldn't have come as a surprise, actually, because we know that patients with acute COVID had a higher incidence of clots. So a deep vein thrombosis, they were having strokes, they were having heart attacks. And actually, as the pandemic has persisted year after year, what we know is that the risk of illnesses where clotting is a factor, such as stroke, heart attacks, pulmonary embolisms, the clots on the lungs, and clots on the legs, whether they're in the arteries or the veins. If you compare the people who haven't had COVID, and this was early on in the first, second year of the pandemic, to the people who have had COVID, the people who've had COVID have a many-fold increased risk of these clotting conditions as compared to patients who didn't have COVID. And this is quite scary, actually.
And it doesn't matter if they have long COVID.
No, it doesn't matter if they've got long COVID. So even if they had the COVID infection and apparently have recovered, their risk is increased in the coming weeks, months. And also, they seem to have a higher risk of things like cognitive impairment, and they seem to have a higher risk of things like Parkinsonism. And why is this? So when I say COVID is not a respiratory disease, what I don't mean is that it doesn't affect the lungs. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that it's not an infection of the lungs, as people might think, you know, like the flu virus. It directly affects the lung tissue, you know, the breathing spaces, the breathing tubes. That's not what's happening in COVID. What's happening in COVID is that you do inhale the virus through your nose and your mouth. But then what happens, it travels to different parts of the body through the blood. So the blood vessels in the floor of the mouth, the virus goes into those, and then through those veins, it actually travels to different parts of the body. So it can go to your lungs, it can go to your limbs, it can go to your heart, other organs, which is why people present so different. So you'll remember that in some variants, you know, people seem to have more of a GI type of presentation. Others might have a sore throat. But even with the same variant, people present differently. And that's because it travels through the blood to different parts of the body. And what's happening in long COVID is that the virus is causing persistent clotting. The clots aren't cleared. And these clots, they reduce the blood supply to different parts of the body, which is why the symptoms are, you know, there's so many. There's more than 200 symptoms of long COVID, and they seem to affect every organ. You know, you've got fatigue, you've got pain, your cognitive issues, breathing issues, GI issues, urinary, you name it. And that's because different parts of the body get reduced circulation, and the patient will develop symptoms related to that part of the body. And that is certainly a mechanism that's playing a part. Now, I'm not saying that's the full story. There are other things as well. There's some evidence that there's development of autoimmunity, particularly, you know, when the disease has gone on for long enough, autoimmune phenomena can develop. There is evidence of immune dysregulation. So a lot of patients will have manifestations like MCAS, which, as we know, you know, goes hand in hand with POTS in a lot of patients. And also there is some suggestion that the virus might linger in patients. Now, there have been attempts to grow live virus in patients with long COVID, but it's actually really hard because the live virus doesn't live very long outside the body and actually is probably hiding in it, what we call immune privileged sites, so sites that the immune system can't reach to neutralize the virus, such as the eyes or the reproductive organs. So actually getting a sample from them is really difficult, as you can imagine. But what has been found is viral particles, debris, which suggests that there may be virus persisting. And the other theme seems to be dysbiosis of the gut. So leaky gut and sort of abnormal gut bacteria, which, you know, give rise to all sorts of symptoms, because if you've got a leaky gut, you'd have inflammatory materials from your gut leaking into the blood and triggering reactions, triggering MCAS, triggering POTS. So there's a lot going on. I think, you know, it's quite similar in some respects to what's happening in ME/CFS. But the thing that really stands out with long COVID is the clotting. It's of a severity that you don't really see with other viruses. And that is what they found in me. I was in that, you know, quite difficult state that I described early on. And I heard that there was a doctor in Germany called Dr. Beate Jäger, who was doing this treatment called atheresis, which is blood washing. And a friend connected us. And she said, I think I might be able to help you. Could you come over? And I did. It was challenging to get to Germany, but managed somehow with the help of relatives. And they put me on this machine, which is a bit like a dialysis machine, but you have a tube in the blood vessels of one arm. And then the blood goes into this machine and it gets cleaned of excess clotting material, basically, in the case of COVID. So that's what she was finding, that these patients had a huge amount of clotting material, which was abnormal. And
did they let you see it after what was left?
I saw it. And my clots were so brittle. They were so hard that normally this machine is used to wash between 3.5 and 4 liters of blood in one session. At the beginning, I was blocking the machine at 2 liters because my clots were so brittle. And it was only through repeated cycles of the treatment and through being put onto anticoagulation that I started getting better results from this treatment.
Knowing what you know now, because I know a lot of patients are listening to this and thinking, do I need to go find a place to try an apheresis machine?
Yes.
Do you think that the anti-clotting treatments, just like the medications, can be effective without having to do this drastic apheresis thing first? Or do you think essential?
Yes, I mean, that's a really important question, because what we don't want is patients obviously forking out huge amounts of money to go and try experimental treatments. And what I can say is that, like with any treatment, you know, it works for some. In some patients, it works temporarily, and in some patients, it doesn't have any effect. And there doesn't seem to be any easy way of predicting who's going to respond. So I had a good response initially, but then I got reinfected. And after that, it didn't seem to do the same for some reason. And I wonder whether that's because one of the other pathologies became more prominent in my case. So there hasn't really been a randomized controlled trial of atheresis. But then these doctors who are busy, you know, pushing the boundaries, trying to save lives, they don't have the time or the funding to do these trials. And, you know, I owe my life to Dr. Jäger and to Professor Pretorius's work and to Dr. Lovche in South Africa, who pioneered the anti-clotting medication. But then again, you know, Dr. Lovche is a busy clinician. He's seeing people from all over the world. He's not got the resources or the funding to do a trial. We actually published as a preprint a case series which showed benefit, but nobody would print it as a peer-reviewed article because, you know, there isn't a control arm. But then it's really difficult because that requires quite a bit of investment, and there doesn't seem to be the interest or the funding. And I think it's become really political now. I mean, long COVID is inconvenient. It's a reminder of bad things for a lot of people. Governments don't want to know, because doing something about it would mean that you have to prevent people from getting COVID. And how do you do that? Well, you do that by cleaning the air and setting up good ventilation systems. You do it by reintroducing masking in indoor places when infection rates are high. Nobody wants to go there. So if they went there, they would be admitting that they've got it wrong all this time. So anyway, I'm digressing, but I guess what I'm saying is that science, as David Petrino, who I'm good friends with, says, is a club. And, you know, it's sometimes about who you know. And the problem is that it takes a lot of money, it takes a lot of time to do these sorts of trials, and patients don't have that time. In terms of the anticoagulation treatment, again, like with any treatment, some people have had a really good result, others partial, some haven't really had significant benefit. And it seems to be that, and again, this is anecdotal, I have to be very clear about this, that the patients who have been sick for longer tend to be the ones where it's harder to demonstrate benefit. And I wonder that whether that's, again, because other phenomena, such as autoimmune phenomena, have sort of become established, and the frequent clotting's not going to hack it. And obviously, if you've got persistent virus or persistent spike protein, then yes, you can treat the clotting, but if you've still got that persistence, it's still going to cause downstream problems. And we don't have a good way yet of clearing persistent virus. You know, there are antivirals like Paxlovid, but, you know, the study that they did on them, 2-week study, didn't demonstrate benefit. So we don't have answers yet. And we're left with people who are seriously ill, who are suffering, who some of them are taking their lives. And because we don't have these studies, there's a reluctance to treat. So they're relying on expensive private physicians who in the US, I imagine, don't take insurance to try these treatments at their own cost. And there's not many of them.
I only know of the long COVID clinic with Dr. Jordan Vaughn, who I believe is looking at the microclotting with the same fancy microscope. Yes. And I believe that at that clinic, maybe they're using some anticoagulation therapy. And is it three different anticoagulants you have to use?
Yes. So, yes, I know Dr. Vaughn, and I am aware that he is looking for the microclots using the same method. And he's actually treating patients with the anticoagulation as well. And he sees people via telehealth as well. But then again, I think, you know, he's a really busy man who's trying to help people and is not able to really spend time doing research. So the reason it's three anticoagulants, and again, I have to say this very cautiously, because what we would never advocate is that anybody do this on their own, because I had expert supervision and monitoring for my treatment. Yes, it's experimental. And, you know, I was fully aware of the risks. I was fully aware of potential benefits. I was told that it might not work. I went into it with my eyes open, with somebody looking after me. And not everybody's going to have that. So please don't buy this at home.
We're not recommending this.
No, absolutely not. But there's several kinds of clotting abnormalities. So one is an abnormality in the clotting enzymes, the what we call clotting factors, where you have excess formation of this protein called fibrin. And so this fibrin in long COVID is insoluble. So normally what happens is you form clots, and with time, the body breaks them down. And what doesn't seem to be happening in long COVID is that breakdown. So it's because these clots are tougher, more persistent, that they give rise to symptoms. So that's one pathway. And what one of the drugs does is it inhibits formation of that fibrin so that the body actually gets a chance to catch up and deal with the existing fibrin. Because otherwise what's happening is the body's breaking it down, it's just being formed at the same rate. The other clotting abnormality is related to these cells called platelets, which are the cells that are really important in the initial part of the clotting cascade. And what happens in COVID and in long COVID is that they become overactive. And so just to give you an example, you know, I'm using very crude terminology here, but my platelets should be like a dot, and mine were like rugby balls, or, you know, when I saw them under the microscope.
Wow.
And yeah, so these platelets have receptors on them, and you need to block them to inhibit their activity. And because there are multiple receptors, the more you can block, the more inhibition you're going to get on the platelets. So, which is why there were two drugs that were used in my case and have been used in the preprint that we put out to inhibit the platelets. So yeah, that's why three drugs have been used, because you can't just address one part of this abnormal clotting cascade. You have to have a multi-pronged attack. And in terms of risk versus benefit, if you gave these three drugs to somebody who didn't have abnormal clotting, then they would have a really high risk of a very serious adverse event, bleeding, which could be serious, it could even be fatal. But what seems to be happening in long COVID patients is because their clotting is already abnormal, they're hypercoagulable, they've got a tendency to form clots, the drugs are just restoring you to the normal clotting physiology. But if you don't have supervision, you will not know when that point comes where actually you are restored and it's time to have that trial off and to see what happens. And that is where the danger lies.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a delicate balance, and which is why you need this expert oversight. Mm-hmm. And it happened in my case. So I was on these three drugs, and I started them in September, October 2021. And I'd take them for a few months, and then I would, together with my physician, make a decision to try coming off them. And each time I would actually relapse. My symptoms would come back with a vengeance. On top of that, I had 6 reinfections. So every time that happened, yes, I deteriorated further. So I had to keep going back on the drugs for that reason. But then at the end of last year, just on a routine blood draw, my GP found that I was anemic. And yeah, and then I had to have a number of investigations for suspected cancer because there was bleeding from the bowel. And so obviously the first thing to think of is bowel cancer. So anyway, I was clear on the lower GI endoscopy, on the colonoscopy, but I had some erosions. So not quite an ulcer, but some areas of oozing on the gastroscopy in the stomach. And so then I had to reduce my anticoagulation. So I'm actually now on one tablet rather than 3. And I seem to be stable. I've not deteriorated. So it may be that in my case, that part of my long COVID is under better control. Mm-hmm. That's not to say I don't still have symptoms. I do. But maybe there's another mechanism for that that's going on.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the other thing is that you can sometimes have bleeding that's quite silent. So I was told that this erosion in itself wouldn't explain the anemia, and that I must be having some bleeding from the small intestine, which is very hard to access. You know, you can't really get an endoscope down there. And actually, even if you do, it's really hard to treat any bleeding point in the small intestine because it's just really hard to access. So I was advised just come down on the anticoagulants and take some iron and see what happens. So it's improving now.
Right.
But yeah, but this is with me, obviously being you know, being stitching myself, being on top of it, making sure I have blood tests, making sure there's action, and having a very good family physician. So I don't mean to, you know, scare patients or put them off. But I guess what I'm trying to say is that, you know, make sure that if you are going to try any long COVID treatment, that you're in the hands of somebody who has got the appropriate expertise and experience. Yeah, and just be aware that not everything is going to work for everyone. That's really important to bear in mind.
Well, and to some extent, this is a reminder of how desperate some long COVID patients like you have been to try some of these things. You wouldn't try them unless you, you know, didn't have a lot to lose, I suspect.
100%. So, I mean, what I will say is that I am aware that a lot of patients do self-medicate with drugs that they buy off the internet. And whilst, you know, I cannot in good faith advocate for that, I can totally understand it because it is so miserable. And there is nothing to lose when you're in that space. And I remember just before Dr. Jaeger got me over to Germany thinking, I can't carry on like this. This is no life. And I actively thought about physician-assisted suicide because I don't know how people carry on for years and years in that state, but they do. I don't think I had it in me to do that. But I think just the thought that my children were still young and also then Dr. Jaeger just came on the scene just in time, that saved me. But yes, at that point, I think I would have tried anything if it was available.
Yeah. And I guess just to give people hope out there, I would want them to know that actually you last year were part of the team that won a research grant from Standing Up to Pods to look deeper into the microclotting. And so this is, even though it might not be getting widespread government-wide NIH funding, there is ongoing research looking into this and finding more ways to help people. And so we hope that, you know, nonprofits like us are filling in the gaps so that patients have...
Which you shouldn't have to, in all honesty, but we're very grateful that you're there. Because I think it would have been fascinating to see what is happening in POTS patients where their POTS isn't due to long COVID or isn't due to ME/CFS. And, you know, they just got the... We're not saying just POTS, obviously, because POTS in itself is a significant condition. But where... You know, it's not one of these causes. Do they have abnormal clotting? And I remember a conversation, I don't know whether it was with you, where we were talking about patients whose ports were getting blocked.
Yes. Research showing that POTS patients, this was a small little study that was only put on a poster session, but in a children's hospital, they looked at all of the different patient populations getting port placement, and POTS patients, I think, had over 50% rate of getting blood clots, and they were the highest rate of any patient population there. But the good news was that anticoagulation therapy did prevent it once they had learned that.
Yes. And I think, again, I'm quite excited about this area because if we can demonstrate that there is abnormal clotting going on in POTS patients, then that opens up the possibility of treatments for POTS patients, even if they don't have blocked ports. And it might help their symptoms. Now, why that might be, why would clots cause POTS? I don't think there's an easy answer to that, but it may be that because there is this reduced circulation, that the nerves that supply the blood vessels in the lower limbs, they're not getting enough oxygen and nutrients. And therefore, when the nerves aren't doing their job, then the blood vessels they're supplying may not be doing their job and not contracting the way they should when you become upright. That's just one possibility. I'm sure it is a lot more complex than that.
Yeah. No, I'm very fascinated by this topic because I was just having my own symptoms that were similar to those of people who had microclots. I've had POTS for 30 years. Nothing changed when I got COVID. my POTS has, you know, remained very consistent all this time. But I ended up getting the microclot test from Dr. Vaughn's lab. I did have the microclots that were present there. And further genetic testing showed that I had the PI1 genetic variant called 4G4G, where you do not break down fibrin. And that seemed like maybe one plausible way that I got to a similar place as some of these other people.
Yes. So that's a really important test. It's not widely available. And not every patient can get that covered. So it's just not available in the UK. We'll stop. And this actually brings me to a really important point. And a lot of patients will go to their doctor or their specialist and, you know, they'll have a test done called a D-dimer, which often is normal in patients with long COVID. And then the patient gets told, well, your D-dimer is normal, therefore you're unlikely to have abnormal clotting. So that happened to me. My D-dimer was completely normal. But what the D-dimer is doing, all it reflects is breakdown of clots. It's the breakdown products of the fibrin.
And yours weren't breaking down.
Exactly. So what's happening in patients who have these clotting phenomena but have not native D-dimer is that the rate of clot formation exceeds the rate of breakdown, or there's just no breakdown happening. So yeah, it's just something to bear in mind. And I just don't think lots of doctors are aware of this. Never mind patients.
Yeah. Well, this is so fascinating. And this kind of brings me to another thing that you have mentioned, which is that evidence-based medicine is not always the thing that is best. And I'm wondering, is that because it's not available when you're out here on the edges? Or maybe you can just talk about that more.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, evidence-based medicine has come to mean in this day and age a randomized controlled trial or a systematic review, which is thought to be the highest level of evidence. But we were still practicing medicine before these kinds of studies. You know, doctors still existed and they still treated patients. But what seems to have happened is that we've developed this sort of treatment paralysis now, where unless something is in a randomized controlled trial in a very high impact journal, then there's no credibility, or we don't have any treatments for that condition. And I think that's quite defeatist, because the reality is that patients who, I'm not saying that these studies don't have a value, of course they do, because they're clean, you know, they have a group with one illness and you have a group which has, you know, no illness or very well defined as sort of minor illness. But people aren't like that in real life a lot of the time. They're messy. They might have more than one thing going on. And also what these trials show is at a population level, what is going on. So if you gave this treatment to, say, 10,000 people, then didn't give it to 10,000 and you gave them a placebo, is there a difference in the rate of benefit between the two groups? And it may be that there isn't, but it may be that within that group of patients who got treated, some improved because of the treatment, but it just doesn't get captured in the calculations. And that's, like you said, on the edges. So if doing some basic statistics, if people remember their sort of bell shaped curve, okay, so most people are sort of, you know, below the thick bit of the curve, but there's the tail that the two ends, and some people are going to be there. So just because the patient isn't effective in a population doesn't mean that there aren't individuals where it might not be effective. So that's one aspect of it. The other aspect to this is that we are where we are with long COVID, in that we don't have randomized controlled trials for treatments. Well, there's one or two very small ones, but by and large, treatments are experimental. So what do you do then? Do we just sit back and go, well, we have to wait for the evidence? We've been waiting 5 years. Well, more than that, not 5.5 years. And people are suffering. They are losing their jobs. They are taking their lives. They're getting more and more disabled. And that's where I think this slavish adherence to evidence-based medicine has caused a lot of damage. Because it used to be that when there wasn't a proven treatment for a condition, a doctor would have a conversation with the patient and say, hey, we're not sure what the best treatment for this condition is, but what we do know is that in some patients, there's a signal that it's helped them, either because there's a case report or a case series, or there's an anecdote, and it makes sense physiologically why this treatment might help. So here are the potential benefits, and these are the potential risks. Shall we give it a go? Shall we try for, 4 weeks, 6 weeks? And then it becomes a case of joint decision-making. And I think that's what's missing. Mm-hmm. Because I can totally understand why your average non-specialist would be reluctant to put their patient on anticoagulant treatment based on, preprints or anecdote or case series. I totally get that, right? What I don't get is the reluctance to put patients on a beta blocker for their POTS, or, pyridostigmine, or in the case of MTAS, on antihistamines, H1 blockers, H2 blockers, because we don't have lots and lots of evidence for these, but we do have STAR, okay? Case reports and case series are still evidence of a lesser degree. And these treatments that I've just mentioned, they are of lower risk. So,
right.
Yeah, I don't know whether I would have had the same approach before I fell ill. I hope I would have, but certainly now I just feel like we cannot justify doing nothing. Yeah. And there is no evidence that doing nothing is beneficial to patients. Mm-hmm. Because a lot of doctors, and these tend to be the people who are in big institutions, they sit in ivory towers, they pump out loads of papers. Like, they don't have the give it a go attitude. They will say, well, there's no evidence that such and such a thing works. Bring me the evidence. Well, that is my answer to them. What is the evidence that you doing nothing is helping this patient? So I just hope that if any doctors are listening to this, that they consider this. And, there is information out there. It might not be the highest quality research, but there is some. There are now guidelines. In fact, I did, as part of the World Health Network, co-authors a guidelines, a Delphi guideline, which is a consensus guideline on how to investigate and treat long COVID. So that's published.
We will put a link to that in the show notes.
Yes, absolutely. So that's something you can refer to. And it just gives you some broad guidance on, things you can do.
Well, that's huge. I mean, that sort of solves that problem for the physician who's hesitant to do anything without a consensus guiding them. So thank you.
Yeah. No, it was a challenge to get it out, because what we call the vanity journals didn't want it, because obviously it wasn't an RCT. And so it was a struggle. I can't claim credit for most of it. I wasn't the kind of lead on it, but I did, obviously, I was playing a significant part in it. So ultimately it ended up in a journal that's maybe less well regarded, but it's still pretty decent. But I don't think that should matter. What matters is, does this make sense? Could this be applied safely? And I think it can.
Fantastic. Okay. Well, we'll be excited to read that from you. And I want to be mindful of your time, but I wanted to ask you one last question. You had previously mentioned or made reference to this experience having some silver lining for you.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that?
Yes, I can. So I remember when I was in that, quite debilitated state, thinking, oh, why has this happened? Like, this is just so inexplicable, because my acute infection was very mild. And obviously we know that you don't have to have a severe initial viral illness to develop quite significant long COVID during CFS. And I was really quite angry because it was preventable in my case, I believe, if I had been given the proper protection, and I wasn't. And I felt it was ironic that I was the one in my department of 50 pulmonologists who kept raising the alarm, kept saying, hey guys, they're all getting sick. What is going on here? These masks are not sufficient. We should protect ourselves. And I got told off for making people anxious or not setting a good example to the juniors. And I still have those sort of WhatsApp conversations stored where I was raising the alarm and people were just sort of, you know, dismissing me as some kind of fearmonger. And anyway, the irony is that I got really badly affected. And that had consequences. And there were a number of consequences. So, you know, there was family breakdown, first of all. So my marriage ended. And unfortunately, it's not been amicable. So that's been quite stressful. There's been some parental alienation as well. So yes, I'm not able to see my children as often as I'd like. My son has developed long COVID as well, and he's quite significantly affected. So he's in school half the time, and half the time he's just in bed at home. But luckily I was able to get him some of the same treatments that I had benefited from early. So he never quite got as bad as me, but he's still significantly affected. I wasn't able to work since November 2020, right through till March 2023, when I was told by the occupational physician that I was well enough to attempt a return to work from home, just doing some remote work. But then the department in which I worked, and I can talk about this openly now, they refused to have me back. And they said that your job was a full-time pulmonologist on the floor, you know, doing overnight calls, and that's what we want you doing. And we want you building up to that we want you building up to 80% of that within 4 weeks. I mean, that was just totally unrealistic. And the occupational physicians agreed that that was ridiculous. So because the occupational physicians couldn't give my chief the guarantee that that would happen, they said he has to just see what he can do. And then it may be that he ends up doing something totally different, maybe some more desk work that other people can spare, and they do more of his clinical work. That would be the logical thing, but that wasn't allowed. So I ended up fighting them through a grievance. And that lasted from March 2023 to November 2023. So my grievance was that I was suffering discrimination on the basis of disability, which is a violation of the Equality Act in the UK. And the other aspects of the grievance were that they hadn't reported my occupational exposure on the basis that they said I couldn't get it anywhere. But I got it during lockdown on a respiratory ward, and I was the first case in my household. So where else would I have got it? I was driving to work solo. I wasn't visiting any shops or anywhere else. So that was nonsense. So I challenged that, because reporting is important, potentially for insurance and income protection and benefit purposes.
Yeah.
And then the other thing that they didn't do was pay me something called injury allowance, which is basically a scheme in the National Health Service where if you get an illness or an injury that's due to work, then it protects your pay up to a level of 85% for a year from the moment it drops. So when you exhaust your full sick pay, the injury allowance should cover you for a year, 85%. And the idea is that allows you to then build up your return to work. It's a very good scheme, but I was declined that on the basis that, well, we can't be sure that this was due to you falling ill at work. So I challenged all of that, and I won. Yes, excellent. I won, and I was actually allowed back to work in November 2023. But the combination of the stress of that process, plus, you know, obviously the, all the personal difficulties, and then a really nasty reinfection that I got in February 2024, meant that I really couldn't get my hours up to a level that was sustainable. So I would hit 6 hours a week and then I would crash. I'd be fine during those 6 hours, which was spread across the week, but then I would pay afterwards. So I then just had to activate my insurance, my disability insurance, which luckily I got because I claimed it quite early on when my pay dropped and they refused injury allowance. Now people are having great difficulty because obviously there's so many claimants. So I was able to access that, and I actually took my pension, my NHS pension, early. And so in November 2024, I gave up work. So now I have my disability payouts and I have my pension, which is enhanced because I'm 49. So my pension isn't that great, but what they do is if you retire on income grounds, they do enhance it a little bit. So those two things, and I have a couple of benefits. So they together are sufficient. Okay. It's not a luxurious life, but I have enough. But in terms of the silver linings, oh, there've been so many. So the amount of learning that I've had about this illness, but also about other illnesses that have been neglected or gaslighted or psychologized or ignored, such as ME/CFS, fibromyalgia, POTS, MCAS, craniocervical instability, you know, vaccine injury, fluoroquinolone toxicity. Apologies if I'm missing any. I mean, I know there's lots of these illnesses, so no offense to any listeners. It's just taught me to see patients with different lens. And, you know, if I do manage to return to practice one day, and I don't know if that would happen, but it might do, then it's going to be with a fresh set of eyes. It's going to be such a privilege to actually look at them and say, you know, I know exactly how you feel because I do. Wow. And I'd like to think that I was already quite empathetic before, but this is sort of next level now because you have walked in their shoes. And that's a real honor and a real privilege. The other silver lining is that it's taught me what's important in life. So I was never a materialistic person, like, you know, gadgets and cars and, you know, fancy house never really mattered much to me. But this has really reaffirmed that what really matters is your health. And if you lose your health, you will lose many other things. Mm-hmm. You lose a lot. But what happens is that you know who your people are. And it's a real good filter. And you will find that there are some people whom you thought would be reliable, be loyal, they would stick by you, and they are nowhere to be seen. On the converse, there are some people whom you might not have given that much time or credit, but actually they're the ones who show up. I'm not saying everybody's like that, but that's been my experience. I've been surprised. And I'm really lucky that I have some really good friends who were just there for me at the drop of a pin. And whereas, you know, the family I created may not exist anymore, but I'm very lucky. I've got an amazing birth family. So siblings, parents who totally believed and supported me 100%. So you know who people are. And I'm just so glad to have that clarity because I'm very judicious with my time now. I will be polite to everyone, but, you know, I will only spend my precious energy where I know that I'm being accepted for who I am and it's not transactional. And I just feel like the opportunity I've had to do research and do advocacy, that's been phenomenal. And that's because I was really stubborn and I was just like, oh, let's get to work on this. This is ridiculous. This is not letting the better of me, okay? And I know that, you know, it's this kind of language is probably not appropriate. It's not a battle, but I just want, nobody's able to explain this to me. I need to connect with all the right people and I need to find out from them what they think. And I built this network and I have built this network. And actually in that network, a lot of people call me the oil because I'm really good at connecting people. And so, and then I realized that actually I had a platform, I had a privilege, I had a position that I could use. So then I advocated on social media for people with these illnesses, actually got into quite a bit of trouble with the psychologizers. But, you know, once you know what the truth is, once you've seen it, then you can't stop talking about it. I don't think I deserved all the kind of praise I've had, but people have said that, you know, I have provided them with hope. And that's been really humbling to hear that if even one person has felt like they can hang on for a little bit more, you know, that's a privilege. So I do not think any of this would have happened without me having gone through what I've been through. So that's a silver lining. Would I do it all over again? Probably not. God, it was mighty and present. Yeah, and it's come at a heavy cost. But yeah, I have to be grateful for these things. And that is what keeps me going.
Wow. Wow. You have so much grace. And I mean, I think this is kind of what you're saying, is that somebody without your credentials and your connections and your history and your reputation for already being a pulmonologist, nobody would believe them if it were just a regular patient off the street. And you being willing to talk about your experiences means so much to the people who are not believed. But then you even take it a few steps further and you are very vocal online. You're an advocate. We'll make sure to put all of your social media links in the show notes if that's okay with you. But absolutely. Then, like you've said, bringing these people together and making this research happen, I'm really excited about the research that you are making happen. And we'll be excited to follow where that goes with the microclotting and all of that. But you've just done so much for this community, and you have just paid the ultimate cost, and you are striving ahead to still do good work for the other patients who maybe don't have the voice or the clout or the credibility that you have. And it's just so incredible, and thank you so much.
I'm a bit embarrassed actually, because I actually don't feel like I've, you know, I don't think I've done that. I think I've done what any decent human being in my position with my credentials could do. And I think it's really tragic that people aren't believed just because of not having a few letters after their name. That should never be the case. We should always believe patients. But yes, if I can use my position and my platform for the community, then I am more than happy to do that. I know not everybody likes speaking out. And I actually am a very private person normally, but I realized that I actually had a gift here that I could utilize for the benefit of myself and possibly to others. So that's what has kept me going. So in the end, it is a bit selfish, not selfish, but you know, it's what gives me hope as well and gives me purpose.
Oh, well. Thank you. Thank you for everything. Listeners, we'll put all of those links in the show notes. And Dr. Khan, thank you again. Maybe we can have you back when you have some of the results from your findings with the South African group on microclotting. And it has been such a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you.
Well, Jill, it's been an absolute honor and a privilege. And I'm so glad we were able to have this chat. It's been a long time in the making. A year and a half, but I'm glad we got to do it in the end. And yeah, thanks to everybody who's listening. And it's a privilege to be part of the community.
Awesome. Awesome. Okay, listeners, that's all for today. We'll be back soon with another episode. But until then, thank you for listening. Remember, you're not alone. And please join us again soon.
As a reminder, anything you hear on this podcast is not medical advice. Consult your healthcare team about what's right for you. This show is a production of Standing Up to POTS, which is a 501c3 nonprofit organization. You can send us feedback or make a tax-deductible donation at www.standinguptopots.org. You can also engage with us on social media at the handle Standing Up to POTS. If you like what you heard today, please consider subscribing to our podcast and sharing it with your friends and family. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts or at www.thepotscast.com. Thanks for listening.